This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
You're listening to World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. Plenty coming up on the programme. We're going to be looking at the decision by the UK to cut its aid budget. It's not the only country to do that. What impact could that have on some of the world's poorest economies? We're going to be talking about Apple, who took a crucial vote on some diversity policies. We'll be telling you what happened there and looking at what may happen to the Philippines economy if AI takes away many jobs there. But if you were listening to the programme with Roger last night, you would have heard Donald Trump talking about a possible deal for Ukraine's mineral resources. Well, 24 hours later, it seems to have happened. Here he is speaking to reporters at the White House.
I hear that he's coming on Friday. Certainly it's okay with me if he'd like to. And he would like to sign it together with me. And I understand that's a big deal, very big deal. And I think the American people, even if you look at polling, they're very happy because, you know, Biden was throwing money around like it's cotton candy. And it's a very big deal. Look, it could be a $1 trillion deal. It could be whatever. But it's rare earths and other things.
Let's bring in Elena Rybakova. She's senior fellow at the Peterson Institute and director of the international program at the Kyiv School of Economics. Elena, we're getting sort of indications of what may be in this deal. What are you hearing about it?
Well, the information is changing minute by minute. But I think first, let's step back and think about it, that for Ukraine, there isn't a choice to have a deal or not to have a deal. Ukraine has to have a constructive relationship with any elected administration in the United States. So Ukraine is pulled into this deal no matter what. But looking at the latest draft, it seems at least we've made it clear who has invaded whom. So the latest draft seems to talk about U.S. support to Ukraine since Russia's full-scale invasion. Mm. Well, that is already an important progress.
It is an important progress. One of the things that has been focused on a lot is this figure of $500 billion in potential revenue that the U.S. appeared to be demanding. Do we know if that's going to be in the deal?
Or potentially trillions. For the moment, it seems to have disappeared from the latest documents. And also, if you look at the latest tweets by the president, his comments, that is no longer there. The information, sort of the reference to this 500 billion, I think he was originally talking about, is no longer there. There are some millions. If you look at the supposed latest document, you have a general discussion that there will be future projects which will be earmarked to this fund, and Ukraine will earmark 50% of the revenues from these future projects. At the same time, the existing projects that are contributing to the budget, which is actually Ukraine's oil and gas majors, are excluded from this particular deal.
When we're talking about Ukraine's mineral resources, what are we talking about? Because there are many mineral resources in Ukraine. Is it oil mainly? Is it gas? Is it these critical minerals that could be so important?
You know, the way what we've heard recently about this deal, it seems to be all of the above. Mm. You know, Ukraine has indeed rare earths. You know, it has titanium, it has other products, it has oil and gas. But in the most recent discussions, we haven't seen any specifics. We have seen Russia rush to produce some national project on rare earth, including from occupied Ukraine. But that is also very vague as well.
Elena, stay with us for a moment. I want to bring in Ayoka Yoshioka, Senior Portfolio Manager, Wealth Enhancement Group, often on the program. That area of critical minerals, that is really important, isn't it, to the US, Ayoka, because China has a lot of control over that area and they are critical in chips and also the green revolution as well.
Absolutely. A lot of these rare earths are utilized in many of our, you know, common day technology, smartphones, computers, chips. And so we do need access to them as, you know, technology continues to become more ubiquitous.
We certainly do. Ayoka, stay with us. Elena, going back to you on this question. OK, so a deal's in place. As you said, we're beginning to hear a little bit more about the deal, probably a little bit better for Ukraine than what Donald Trump was indicating earlier in the week. But in terms of exploiting these natural resources, Ukraine is a country at war, so it could be some time before we see them being exploited.
Absolutely. You just sort of took my comment. For any corporate to be investing, they don't want to see missiles flying around, right? You know, even the most adventurous corporates, they still want to have at least some basic security. And what we don't seem to be getting from this deal, apart from the general words of support to free, sovereign and secure Ukraine, again, that is very important, but there are no explicit guarantees. So it's not clear. Maybe in the subsequent arrangements, certain corporates might get security or other guarantees from the government. Then there could be indeed exploration. But until then, I think it remains very vague.
And the EU, will they be disappointed with this deal being struck? Because surely they would have wanted some access to these resources.
Absolutely. And we've just seen the beginning of the discussions happen between Ukraine and European authorities, you know, maybe China next. From the leaked documents or the comments we have seen so far, it's not clear if this deal will preclude Ukraine from concluding similar deals with anybody else. And that would be an important sticking point.
As always, thank you so much for joining us on World Business Report there and giving us your analysis of that story that is, we're continuing to get more details on. Further coverage, of course, here on the BBC World Service. The British Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, has announced that he's boosting defence spending to reach 2.5% of GDP within the next 2 years. To pay for it, he's slashing overseas aid for some of the world's poorest countries, like Afghanistan. That is a growing trend. The US has cut back on its aid programme as well. So what impact is this having on people in some of the world's poorest economies? Winnie Byanyima is the executive director of UNAIDS. She says it's already affecting people in some African countries.
Right now, for them, this is not just a debate. This is not just a policy shift. One person living with HIV has described it as, this is a death trap. Please talk to the American government that this is a death trap for us. If I don't get my tablets next month and the following month, how much longer will I have to live?
Let's bring in Ken Rogoff, former chief economist at the IMF. Ken, thanks for joining us on the program again. There's a lot of focus on the US, the UK, you know, cutting down on these aid budgets. But let's talk money. How significant is the money that comes from these two countries? Let us go back to Ken in a minute. But it's also a subject that we've been discussing with Uma Amara Ekeruche, who's senior research fellow at the Center for the Study of Economics of Africa.
Most African countries will be affected, but particularly the low-income countries, right, that are really dependent on aid. They are not big enough to attract investments, right? But also countries where there's a humanitarian crisis. For instance, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Uganda as well, again, low-income countries.
Do you think that some of those countries that you're talking about in Africa worry that they're seeing the US change its policy, they're seeing the UK change its policy, and that other countries may change their policies, like Germany, maybe France?
So I'm happy you mentioned Germany and France, countries that have already begun to also reduce aid. These countries in the past used to be major donors, right, to African countries. So yes, once the US and the UK have gone or turned towards a certain direction, the likelihood that other European countries will follow is very high.
We know that aid is important to some African countries, not all, but many African countries have seen their economies grow. So how crucial is it nowadays, do you think?
I would say it is crucial just because aid cuts across so many sectors, right? So I've talked about countries that are facing humanitarian crisis, but also we have the agriculture sector. Remember, you said had the Feed the Future program, which was a huge program in both low and even middle income African countries. The electricity sector as well, they had the Power Africa program, trade and investments, they had Prosper Africa. Health as well. They've been very instrumental in HIV and AIDS prevention, even malaria as well, the fight against malaria. So the effects of the decline in aid will be very much felt across a lot of sectors. Mm. However, we think this is a step in the right direction with regards to curbing aid dependency.
What do you mean by that, aid dependency?
The idea or the notion that we have to continue depending on free money, right, from developed countries. There's really no free money, right? One of the first things they teach you in a cons class is that there's no free lunch. So it may appear free, but there are definitely strings attached to that kind of money, right? Aid or donor money.
Just a final question to you on this. If that money, and you're right, we hear a lot about aid dependency and it's something that needs to be broken, but if the money isn't available from some of the countries we're talking about, the US and the UK, could some of those African countries just turn to China more now?
That's a possibility. But what we're seeing on the continent, right, is that countries are now looking inwards. At the just concluded African Union meeting, it was top of the agenda. So countries are now looking inwards, talking about tax, domestic resource mobilization, trying to get their tax regime, tax codes, tax strategies in order. Countries are also now looking to add additional value to natural resources. So rather than export oil or export copper or export gold, add value on the continents so that that increases our economic base. And countries are looking to, as much as possible, attract healthy investments, engaging with the private sector abroad, and also building private sector capabilities on the home front. Mm.
Let's go back to Kenneth Rogoff, who was the former chief economist at the IMF. We're looking a lot, we're discussing a lot. Globally, it's a conversation about what's happening with aid, with the US and the UK cutting down on it. But how significant are those contributions in the wider schemes of things, Ken?
Well, I think in one area, it's really important, which is health, which is probably only maybe a quarter of what the U.S. gives. A lot of the other money is used for trying to get political leverage or strategic leverage. You know, it's done in a more subtle way than Trump is doing right now with Ukraine, but certainly that's what it is. But the health piece is very important because the Western countries had a lot of the technology and expertise that's not easily replaced. So cutting it off so suddenly is really incomprehensible. It's incredibly cruel.
Yeah. And health, of course, you need a good health system in place, don't you, if you want to see your economy continue to develop. We talk a lot about aid. We seem to focus on Africa, often wrongly, because if we look at the US budget, most of the money was going to Ukraine and Israel, Jordan number three in there. So it's money that goes to many different parts of the world, isn't it?
No, that's right. I mean, the U.S. has always used its aid almost as a substitute for military investment. It's used it very strategically, much more so than, say, Sweden or Norway, even the United Kingdom. So, you know, some of the cutbacks just directly hurt U.S. interests to the extent they were advancing them. The U.S. gives a very modest share of its income and aid. Its economy is much bigger than everyone else. So even though it's a small percent, we're still the biggest. But what's really awful here is the suddenness. I mean, the cost is much bigger than the dollars lost. Mm. You hired a doctor. The doctor moved to your village in order to be able to practice at the hospital. Suddenly, there's no money. I mean, the cost, it's not just the, you know, one-time thing. It's a much bigger disruption sweeping across development and particularly the healthcare system across Africa. But also, you could look at Mexico, you know, Latin America, many other countries which are getting hit by this. There's some very poor countries in Latin America, Bolivia, for example.
Do you think more countries will get hit by this? We've seen the UK today cut down on its aid budget because it has to increase its military spending. That is a situation that many European countries are facing. Will others make the same decision, do you think?
Well, it remains to be seen, but it's certainly the case that Europe is being pressed to spend more on its military, both by Russia, China and the United States. The United States is probably going to end up spending more on its military. So that's certainly one of the factors underlying this. I mean, that, and I think your previous person rightly said that African countries are waking up to that. They have to deal with it. They have to find a way forward. They have to be less dependent. And there, you know, there's some good that comes from that, but not for the people who need AIDS drugs or hospital care for their children right now.
How do you build an economy? You've been part of, you know, the IMF trying to do this. Build an economy, whether it's in Africa, whether it's in parts of South Asia or Latin America, and cut that dependency on aid, because it's not easy to do, is it?
It's not easy to do, and it's a long story, but part of it is the aid is used as leverage for, you know, to put political players get money, they're able to get votes. So it isn't straightforward. I think the issue of aid dependency is a very important one, but had this been done gradually with a conversation with Africa and South Asia and countries in Latin America that really depend on it, we could make sense of it. Yeah,
but some would say,
so chaotically.
Yeah. So, some would say, look, that, as you rightly said, that system hasn't worked to reducing aid dependency. Maybe you have to do something extreme to actually change it.
Well, I mean, I think aid dependency numerically has gone down. There's certainly some African countries, you know, Somalia, Malawi, that depend very heavily on aid for their government budget. But as I think you noted, Africa's been growing. The aid has not been growing. So, you know, by numerically, aid as a share of African income has been going down.
Ken, always a pleasure to have you on the program and to get your thoughts on that story, one that we will continue to follow here on World Business Report. You are, of course, with World Business Report here on the BBC World.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
Service. Now, on this program over the past few weeks, we've been looking at the impact that the Trump presidency has been having on many different aspects of the global economy. One area we focused on is DEI practices in corporate America. If you're wondering what DEI stands for, it's Diversity, Equity and Inclusion Programs. Donald Trump is not very keen on them. Apple, one of the world's biggest companies, on Tuesday rejected proposals to scrap their DEI program. Here's a reminder of what's been happening in corporate America for Matt Lyons since President Trump's election.
This week, I will also end the government policy of trying to socially engineer race and gender into every aspect of public and private life.
President Trump at his inauguration there, signalling a change to diversity, equity and inclusion policies across the United States. And for some, the call to drop the initiatives altogether. Big businesses across America have already worked to scale them back. Following Donald Trump's victory back in November, Walmart was one of the first, announcing plans to wind down the Center for Racial Equity nonprofit that it had founded in 2020. In January, McDonald's followed suit, abandoning specific diversity targets. Then tech titans Meta, Alphabet and Amazon said they would make changes to hiring practices. In banking, JP Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley and Citigroup are all removing or watering down language around diversity. And then there are big brands including Costco, where investors voted strongly against plans to assess risks from being more inclusive. Overall, last year, shareholder proposals to counter DEI programs got less than 2% of support on average. Now, in the latest move, Apple shareholders have rejected a plan to consider ending DEI programs.
That is the case. Of course, a part of DEI is values. That's something that Tim Cook has spoken about a lot. He, of course, is the person running Apple. He is giving an address to graduating students at Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C. back in 2022.
Whatever you do, lead with your values. By leading with your values, what I mean is that you should make decisions, big and small, each and every day, based on a deep understanding of who you are and what you believe. These are not static things, and you wouldn't want them to be. You will learn more and grow more with each passing year, as all of us do.
Where Tim Cook said that was important because Gallaudet is a private university which supports the education of deaf and hard of hearing people. We wanted to get reaction from an Apple shareholder, somebody who invests in the country too, today's vote. So I've been speaking to Dom Rizzo, who runs the portfolio of T. Rao Price Global Technology Fund.
Yeah, I think, look, Apple is always very thoughtful in all of their programs. And when we look at what Apple's always trying to do is just kind of recruit the best talent wherever they can find it. And I think that became very clear from the AGM today.
But Apple has taken this stance. It's a stance that many other American companies have decided not to take. What have you made of Donald Trump's comments on DEI policies?
I think what the Trump administration is trying to do and what all companies are trying to make sure they do is just make sure that whoever's hired is the best person for the position. And I think what Apple's trying to do and a lot of the technology companies is doing is making sure that they find that talent wherever that may be. And so I kind of expect that to be the case going forward for most American enterprises. And we'll see how the laws change and what rules change going forward. But I think most companies are trying to find the best talent wherever they can find it.
Does it worry you that a company that you invest in seems to be going down a different line to the president of the U.S.?
I don't know if that's how I would classify what Apple's done. I mean, I think what really came across to me from the AGM today is that Apple's really focused on building in America. You know, they really emphasize the $500 billion projects all around the world, right? Apple's so big, when they move, they really move a lot of different parts of the supply chain. And so I'm not sure that's how I would classify what we saw today.
I'm going to ask you a final question. And I get the sense from what you're saying, look, you're a shareholder, you want to look at the much wider way that a company is performing, and DEI, you know, may not be a huge part of that. Do you think people are finding it difficult to talk about this issue at the moment?
No, funny enough, what the Trump administration is focused on is making sure that talent is always being measured by who is the best person for the job. And I think actually, if you go look at Donald Trump's statements throughout history, he's actually been very, very clear about that. And I think the question is, have companies had policies in place that aligned with that? And can you make sure that you're doing that going forward? And I think the answer in Apple's case is yes.
Dom Rizzo there, who is an investor in Apple. Ayoka Yoshioka still with us. Ayoka, it was interesting to hear that. Dom, you got a sense, didn't really want to talk too much about DEI. And do you think that's the case with a lot of shareholders at the moment? It's been put on the agenda, but it's not something a lot of people want to deal with.
I think so. I think there's enough uncertainty and a lot of other issues going on with many of these companies outside of DEI to focus on really, you know, looking at what is impacting these companies from a revenue and earnings standpoint.
Let's talk about a company that is not having a great time on the stock market at the moment. That's Elon Musk. Tesla stock's down 8%. That means its market value now down below $1 trillion. What's caused the drop?
Yes. So today we saw Tesla actually saw a decline in their EV sales in Europe. So 45% fewer sales in Europe in the month of January versus last year. And that actually hit Tesla quite a bit today.
Do you think you're there, you know, in the same part of the world that Elon Musk is on the West Coast? Do you think there is concern amongst Tesla shareholders that he is so political now that that might put some people off from buying his car?
I think, you know, the overall investor base either loves him or dislikes him. And I think each shareholder can reflect that in whether or not they own Tesla shares or not.
Yep, it certainly is an interesting time for the company. Right. We talk a lot on this program to people like Ayoka about the impact of AI, what impact it could have on companies. Also could have a big effect on many economies, which could see part of their workforces being replaced by AI. The Philippines is one of them. My colleague Sam Fenwick has been looking at how AI could disrupt its financial future and how it's trying to prepare.
I think AI is just a tool. It really can't replace people because people need to have emotions, and AI just could not give emotions, especially for customer service. I think the human touch is really needed there.
So at the moment, AI hasn't cost you any jobs. You haven't thought, oh, that job could be done by AI, so I'm going to lose that person. But could that happen in the future, do you think?
I think it could happen, especially the data entry jobs.
Should the people that work in this sector be worried about that?
I think they should, because that's one of the most basic jobs. Data entry jobs require human intervention because they need to distinguish text from images or a lot of data from a table. But if an AI can do it, I think for the data entry jobs, it's going to be obsolete in a few years.
So if AI could take outsourcing jobs away from the Philippines, what will replace them? The Philippine government is actively working to diversify its economy by investing in infrastructure. And one of the most significant investments is the Metro Manila subway station. Here's our reporter, Camille Alemia.
I am here at the subway station being constructed in Quezon City. It is a sunny Saturday morning and it is very busy here. Everyone is working. We see them operating trucks, cranes, and huge bulldozers as they try to lay the groundwork. The entire subway project has an estimated total cost of around $8.3 billion, of which around 80% will be financed through a loan from Japan. Filipinos, including myself, are now eagerly awaiting for its completion, which is targeted in 2029.
The new subway, along with improvements to Manila's main airport and several major bridge and building projects, aims to create jobs, enhance connectivity, and attract more foreign investments. But is it working? Well, according to Minette Navarrete, president of Kickstart Ventures, it is.
There have been a number of companies that started out in the Philippines, but have gone on to other countries. But similarly, we see companies, startups, from outside the Southeast Asian region coming into the Philippines. And so by building these two-way bridges, we're seeing that we can help take technological advances and new business models to make life and business better. For many companies, what's attractive is the Philippine demographic. The median age is 25 years old. The young population is just entering the workforce. It's more digitally savvy. It feels more socially aware, more globally connected. And all that makes for a base of both consumers as well as talent.
Minette Navarrete there, ending that report from Sam Fenwick. We began it with Paul Rivera, who is a entrepreneur in the Philippines there, whose business is incorporating AI, looking at the sort of impact that it could have on staffing there. If you want to hear Sam's full report, go to our sister program, Biz Daily. Just search for Business Daily on the BBC website or wherever you get your podcast. We will be back with Business Matters at 0100 GMT. We'll be taking you to Pakistan. We'll also be taking you to Texas in the United States. So join us for that program.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.